Blue Dot Episode 8, Return to the Moon.
This is Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom.
And I'm Matt Schiltz, and today we're talking about the moon, but we haven't landed there since 1972.
Since December of 1972, it's hard to believe that it's been that long. And, you know, it's amazing. You hear people say all the time, you know, they can land a man on the moon, but they can't, you know, fill in the blank, whatever you want to put there. But it's been a long time since human beings have walked on another world.
So why today? Why are we talking about the moon now?
Because now we're starting to build a new rocket system that's capable of taking us back to the moon and capable of taking us to Mars or to asteroids. And the moon is our nearest neighbor in space. And it makes sense to start exploration there first, to start learning how to go out and explore other worlds on the moon, because it's only 3 days away.
And it's not just a ball of rock. There's actually things there that we can use.
No, there are resources on the moon, and we're going to talk to some NASA scientists, and one in particular, to talk about some very exciting resources on the moon that we can use to, you know, use as rocket fuel and to make oxygen for astronaut colonists to breathe. And we're going to talk about how the moon can be used as a resource, and that could be a stepping stone to go to Mars eventually, the best way to, you know, actually get there. We're going to be talking to Dr. Pamela Clark from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory about a new mission that's coming up. It's going to be the first test of the new NASA Space Launch System that is a powerful rocket that can take humans back to the moon. But they're going to first test it out by launching some little satellites to study all kinds of interesting things about the moon.
CubeSats.
And then after that, we're going to take a little whimsical tour to talk about a song that went to the moon and was very popular with the Apollo astronauts back in the 1960s. Old Blue Eyes is back with us. We're going to be talking about the song Fly Me to the Moon. But our first guest is Jennifer Heldman. She's at NASA's Ames Research Center. She's a scientist who specializes in the moon.
She's going to talk about something called LCROSS, that's the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite.
She's going to talk about the LCROSS mission that detected and confirmed that there is water ice on the moon that could be used as a resource for exploration and to learn about how it got there in the first place. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to talk to you about the upcoming mission to return to the moon that's a follow-up to the LCROSS mission. Can you give us quickly, you know, review for us what LCROSS was?
Sure. So LCROSS was the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite, and that's where we launched to the moon and we impacted the upper stage of the launch vehicle into the moon to kick up a big plume of dust and debris and ice, as it turns out. And then we flew right through that plume with another spacecraft to measure what was in it so we could see what was actually in the ground that got kicked up. And what we found was more ice, really, than we were expecting, on the order of 5 to 6%, which for the moon is quite a bit of ice. And so that sort of answered the zero-level question, is there water ice on the moon? And with LCROSS, we could say, yes, in this crater near the south pole of the moon, there's water ice there. So that was really exciting.
What is the real attraction for us for water ice on the moon? Why do we really care about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a couple reasons we care. One is for the science, because we're interested in knowing where is there water in the solar system, and especially near our nearest neighbor, the moon, because we're still trying to answer the question, where did Earth get its water from? Where did our water come from? Impacts from comets and asteroids. And so by looking at the moon, we can try and figure out where the inventory came. Where did the water come from? So there's a science question. And then there's also an exploration question. Because when we start sending people back to the moon and they stay for a longer period of time, we don't want to have to truck all the water we're going to need or all the fuel we're going to need to the moon every time. You really want to learn how to live off the land. And that's something that we call in-situ resource utilization, ISRU, basically using the things that are on the moon so that we can actually stay there longer and survive. So if we're finding there are reservoirs of water ice on the moon, that's fantastic, because that means when we send the people there, they can use the water, not just for drinking, you know, brushing your teeth, but also because water is made up of H2O, hydrogen and oxygen. And those are the two components of rocket fuel. So if you can produce your own rocket fuel on the moon, then you've got fuel, a fuel stock right there. And so that really enables you to do more things, longer period of time on the moon.
Well, let's talk about the next step. We've got a mission plan to go investigate this site, right? And that's called the Resource Prospector. Can you tell us a little bit about that? That's a rover, isn't it?
Sure, yes, that's absolutely right. So Resource Prospector is the follow-on to LCROSS. We did LCROSS and we found, okay, yes, we know that there's water on the moon. Great. So the next step to figure out in greater detail, okay, where is that water? You know, sort of on the human scale, if you're walking around on the moon, where's the water? So Resource Prospector will send a rover to the moon near one of the poles, the north or the south pole of the moon, because the poles are where it's the coldest, the longest, so that's where the ice is. And we'll drive around and prospect and map out where that ice is. So now we can figure out, okay, where is it? Where is it concentrated? And help us figure out, okay, if we are going to send a moon base and, you know, establish a base on the moon, where should we do it? Because we probably want to set that up somewhere where we can access that those water reservoirs. So Resource Prospector will go, it'll drive around, it's got some instrumentation where we can sort of interrogate the moon, figure out where the ice is. It has a drill on it, so we can drill down and actually touch the ice, bring it up into our instruments, and get really high-resolution data telling us where that water is. And we can match that with what we learn from orbit, from remote sensing data from the moon. We can't get quite the resolution from orbit. That's why we have to get down on the ground with a rover.
It's been since 1972 since humans walked on the moon. The last man on the moon was Gene Cernan. And the Apollo astronauts are, you know, leaving us one by one as they get older. Is there a real plan now to return human presence to the moon in the next decade?
I hope so. I hope so. And we're trying to do it. You know, Apollo was wonderful, and we learned so much. And now when we send humans back to the moon again, we'd like to send people to stay for longer periods of time. And with Apollo, you got to go for a little while and then come back. So NASA's really taking a thoughtful and strategic approach to this now by doing these, what we call robotic precursor missions, you know, sending these missions before we send the people so that we can really plan out, okay, when we send the people, what's the best way to do that? So we started that with LCROSS. You know, figuring out where the water is. Follow that up with Resource Prospector. You know, figure out, okay, where is the ice? Do some ISRU demonstration missions to prove that you can actually do it. So hopefully when we send people back to the moon again, it will be for a longer, more sustained presence, which would be really great.
And when do you think Resource Prospector is likely to be on the moon?
The current plans, NASA's still working out the schedules and whatnot, but probably in the late 20-teens or so would be the launch. So there's no defined launch date right now, but we're looking at launches, you know, in a few years from now, and we're looking at both North Pole and South Pole targets to figure out where we would actually send this rover to get the best data to inform where that water is.
We see a lot, like, for example, the movie The Martian was very popular and featured in NASA in the future. Going to Mars is a big goal for a lot of people that are interested in space flight and in human exploration. Why does going back to the moon make sense as a stepping stone to that?
Right. So the argument has been made since the moon is only 3 days away, that you can go there and you can test things out before you go all the way to Mars, which is much, much further, is a much longer time delay, is much harder to get to. And so the philosophy behind going to the moon first is, okay, let's go test our technologies. Let's test our concepts of operation. You know, let's test how things work on the ground and on the moon and how this all interacts together, and then get things really, really working well as best we can, and then take those lessons learned and then apply them to the Mars case. Because I want to go to Mars, too. There's great science to be done at Mars. So I hope that we get to go to both.
And when you talk about a rover, one thing that's kind of interesting to me is we've talked to people who are involved in doing the software to drive the Martian rovers around Curiosity and Opportunity and Spirit before that. And you've got that long time delay where you have to have a semi-autonomous robot that knows what to do. You can't just drive it around in real time. But that's not quite true with the moon, is it?
Exactly, right. That is one of the really, really fun parts about Resource Prospector. And we've been doing a lot of testing. We've been doing field testing with rovers out in the desert and, you know, the science team, you know, back at NASA controlling the rover. because you're right, the moon is so much closer that we can have what we call real-time operations on the moon. And that's the exact way that we'll be running Resource Prospector. We will see the data coming back from the moon in real time. And the science team actually has the job of watching that data and reacting to it. So when we see something interesting, you know, we drive over a spot and the data seems to indicate there's ice there, we call out stop. We say stop, and they stop the rover, right? And so you can't do that on Mars. You can't have that real-time interaction back and forth. And so that's one of the really interesting challenges of how to do this rover operation for the moon, because now we have a science team that's fully integrated into the mission operation and is reacting to the data that's coming back. And so it's really exploration-driven. And so we, as the science team, are very excited because we can change the plans on the fly. We can change our mind, and we can have the rover go over here because there's something interesting there that we didn't know about. And so it's a really different concept of operations, but it really helps us maximize the data we get back because we have a limited amount of time to do this mission. So the water on the, or the water ice on the moon is near the poles because that's where it's cold. But that also means we have limited sunlight. So we may only have a week or two when we're in the sun when we can actually do this mission. We'll be working 24 hours a day for as many days as we can. And so that's why we want to make sure that every moment counts. And so the science team is intimately involved with what the rover is doing and when and where it goes and all its activities.
So just to be clear, the radio travel time at the speed of light to the moon is about a second, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And then you add in, you know, I think for Epcot, the round trip ended up being about 6 seconds or so because you go through the deep space network and get all that data back. So there's a slight delay, but it's a much, much less than Mars case.
It's a lot different than 20 to 30 minutes.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. Jennifer, I really enjoyed talking to you today. It's really interesting to hear about this. And returning to the moon is something that's always fascinated me. I would have thought at my age of 56 now that we would have been back there by now. When did you first get interested in the moon as a target for exploration? When did that first get interesting to you?
I think I first realized the moon was something interesting was in about third grade. And we had an old telescope in our basement and just pulled it out in the backyard one day and looked at the moon. And I never realized that the moon was an actual place. Like, you look through your telescope and you can see mountains and you can see, you know, there's geology on the moon and it's an actual place with rocks and lava. And, you know, it's a place you could go and you could walk on. And then once I realized that that was a real thing and a real place, then I got really interested in it. So I think that's kind of where it started.
Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Jennifer Heldman, a researcher at NASA Ames and a specialist on the moon.
You're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR, and we're talking about the moon. When we come back, we will talk to Dr. Pamela Clark from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. She's going to tell us about some things called CubeSats that will be exploring the moon in a small way and in a big way. We're back. Welcome back to Blue Dot on NSPR. We're going to be talking in a few minutes to James Kaplan about Frank Sinatra's very famous song, Fly Me to the Moon, which was really popular with the Apollo astronauts. But first, we're going to talk to Dr. Pamela Clark from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena about something called the CubeSats and how we're going to get them there with the first really powerful rocket that the United States has built since the Saturn V took us to the moon back in the late 1960s and early 70s. Pamela, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
First of all, could you tell us about what your role is specifically in the mission? What do you do?
Well, I am the science PI, principal investigator, for one of the three CubeSats that will be deployed by EM-1, and that's basically a test of the Orion crew capsule that will be launched and put into a figure-eight-like orbit, just like the Apollo 8, actually, the Apollo 8 orbit. And after it's deployed, there will be 13, NASA officially announced 13, which will include 13 CubeSats, which will be deployed from a ring. And those three are Lunar IceCube, the mission on which I'm science PI, Lunar Flashlight, which is a JPL mission, and Luna Map, L-U-N-A-H Map, which is a Arizona State University mission. And Lunar IceCube is actually the PI for the mission is Ben Malfris from Morehead State University.
And PI is principal investigator.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to our listeners what exactly is a CubeSat?
Well, that's an interesting question because it means a lot of things to a lot of people. You know, the initial thought was CubeSat means a cube was a 10 by 10 by 10 centimeter cube, about the size of a Beanie Baby box, as Bob Twiggs, who is one of the inventors of CubeSat, likes to say. And the idea was to get small, expendable packages, essentially just glorified instrument packages that could be put together quickly and launched to give students a chance to build packages that would be flying in space, a step up from balloon payloads or suborbital rocket payloads. Really, over the what is striking about the CubeSat paradigm is not it's compact. That's very important. That minimizes the cost due to mass and makes the volume very small, which is all good to keep the cost down. But it's really the paradigm for developing a CubeSat mission and putting it, building it and testing it, which is basically fast, low cost, with a very different way of dealing with risk.
Talking about these CubeSats and learning about them, I wonder if you see, as someone who is intimately involved in their use, do you see like a huge fleet of these in our solar system in the near future?
Well, what I do see right now is that there's a lot of investment going on in the private sector to develop vehicles that'll get small spacecraft like CubeSats into low Earth orbit. It's considered to be, even though there's probably not as much government investment, it's being taken very seriously, and there's a tremendous effort to get things into low Earth orbit. And as we improve the propulsion systems available to CubeSats and create more ones that are more compact, that can create more delta V, we will be able to eventually use LEO at low Earth orbit as a staging ground. And then some of these people, these developers of launch vehicles and carriers, want to go way beyond low Earth orbit anyway. They want to go into GEO, higher Earth orbit, or Earth escape trajectories. So yes, I do. I think within the next 10 years, the new high ground is going to be cislunar space.
You're listening to Blue Dot, and we've been talking to Pamela Clark. She's the systems engineer for NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and she's been talking to us about the Lunar Ice CubeSats. Pamela, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Certainly. It was a great pleasure.
Next, we're going to talk to James Kaplan. He's the author of Frank, The Voice, and Sinatra, The Chairman, the two-part biography of Old Blue Eyes himself. And he's going to tell us about the recording of a pretty special song in the history of space exploration and the moon. And here's a little bit of it.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song.
Well, James, Frank Sinatra was not the first person to record this song, was he?
Not by a long shot, no. He was the 100th and first.
Tell us a little bit about the origins of this song.
The song was written by a guy named Bart Howard, who had made his living as a pianist for singers like Mabel Mercer and Eartha Kitt, cabaret singers in New York, mainly at a club called the Blue Angel in the early 1950s. And in 1954, he wrote this song, which he called In Other Words, and that was the name of the song for the next 10 years. The song was recorded extensively, mainly by women, and In Other Words was written by Bart Howard, music and lyrics, as a waltz. And so it was invariably recorded as a waltz by Nancy Wilson, by Kay Ballard, by Peggy Lee.
And then what led Frank Sinatra to decide to tackle this particular song?
Well, he loved Count Basie. He loved Count Basie. He had first seen Count Basie, seen and heard Count Basie way back in the late 1930s, when Frank was an unknown, when he was in his early 20s and haunting West 52nd Street in New York. Between 5th and 6th Avenues, West 52nd Street used to be an entire block of jazz clubs, and you could stroll down that block of an evening and take in great geniuses, the likes of Lester Young and Billie Holiday and Count Basie. So Sinatra had been listening to the Count forever. He loved his piano playing. He loved his big bands, and he wanted to work with him. And he did in 1963. He made an album with Basie, his first album, arranged by Neil Hefti. But then that was earlier than 63. It was a couple of years before that. But in 1964, by this time Sinatra had met Quincy Jones and really wanted to work with Quincy Jones, and Jones was arranging for Basie, and so Sinatra decided that he wanted to do another album, another Basie album, this time arranged by Quincy.
And what is it about this version with Frank and, of course, with his marvelous voice, but also the arrangement? What is it about it that makes it the seminal classic version of the song?
He had done this before, Sinatra had. He'd done it a number of times. Most notably, I would say, with a song called You Make Me Feel So Young, which before Sinatra did it on Songs for Swingin' Lovers in 1956, had been completely unknown. It was in an obscure movie in 1946, and until Sinatra's music finders, there are people he worked with who helped him dig up songs, dug that one up for him. Nobody had ever heard of You Make Me Feel So Young. He turned it into an instant classic. Now, In Other Words was not an obscure song by any means. It had been done many times. But Sinatra had heard a Basie album, an instrumental album, called This Time by Basie. And This Time by Basie contained an instrumental of In Other Words that Sinatra just dug the hell out of. He thought it was fantastic, and it was not performed, this Basie instrumental was not performed as a waltz, but performed, it was played in 4/4 time, which meant that it was a little more propulsive, sort of more a more loping, swinging sound. Sinatra just loved it, and he wanted to do a vocal of it that way.
And then, of course, you know, I don't know that he was thinking of it this way at the time. He was probably just thinking about it musically. The song becomes attached to the Apollo Moon program. And it's kind of ironic because Frank had, you know, helped get John F. Kennedy elected. John F. Kennedy was the one that set the goal to go to the moon.
Yeah.
Of course, they had their famous falling out together, and Kennedy was assassinated. But the song became a NASA favorite, and it actually flew to the moon, didn't it?
It did. It did. It was. Now, let me get this straight. It was played in the orbiter and then played on a cassette machine on the lunar surface. Is that the case?
Well, it was played by Gene Cernan as they were flying the lunar module about 50,000 feet in a test run before Apollo 11. This is the Apollo 10 mission. And Cernan loved the song, and so did Tom Stafford, the commander of that mission. And I know they had it. In fact, it's become one of those space artifacts that's very highly prized. The cassette still exists, and it's been authenticated by Gene Cernan that they did that tape exists. And I've heard that it was also played on the surface of the moon by Buzz Aldrin, but I'm not sure about that.
Right. I think that's beyond urban mythology. I think there may be truth to that.
Yeah.
I think Aldrin actually did play it on a portable player on the surface of the moon. And there is no greater song to play on the surface of the moon than Frank's version of that song. Sinatra really transformed the song from something kind of dreamy, wispy, almost wistful, into something propulsive and, dare we say it, macho. This was Sinatra recorded the song with Basie, a beautiful arrangement by Quincy Jones, in June of 1964. And this was, speaking of irony, the Beatles had appeared on Ed Sullivan just 4 months earlier. Precisely 4 months earlier, the British invasion had begun, and with it, the destruction of the popular music business as Sinatra knew it. The attack was on, and yet Sinatra was fighting back with every weapon in his arsenal. He was at the height of his swinging bachelorhood, and yet soon to turn 50 the following year. He was feeling a little bit vulnerable, same time feeling very, he was feeling his oats, and he really put it all into this song.
Well, James, it was a joy talking to you about this wonderful song.
Dave, it's a joy talking to you about it, and thank you so much for thinking of me.
Well, Matt, when the next generation of astronauts returns to the moon, whoever they might be and when, I wonder what music they'll take with them.
I wonder that, too, and I'm sure it'll be an exciting moment, but what I'm really excited about and what I'm sure a lot of people are really excited about is that it does sound like we are going to be going back to the moon in our lifetimes.
And it's about time. My hope is that there are a few living Apollo astronauts left, and I hope that before they leave us that they get to see at least an orbital mission to the moon.
What's the over-under?
Well, I would not expect an orbital mission to the moon until the outside. I think 2020 is a conservative estimate. That's only 4 years away. Yeah, I'd like to thank our guests, Jennifer Heldman, research scientist from NASA Ames in Mountain View, Pamela Clark from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and biographer James Kaplan, expert on all things Frank Sinatra. You've been listening to Blue Dot on NSPR. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News or me at Dave Shlom, who reminds you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.